Welcome to Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 4th, 2025. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. In June, Prime Minister Mark Carney announced he planned to boost defense spending to 5% of Canada's GDP over the next decade. What will this mean for workers, for the economy? And more broadly, what does this signal about Canada's priorities, especially when it comes to fighting the climate crisis and honoring Indigenous rights? Can massive military investment coexist with these commitments, or are they fundamentally at odds? Today on Rabble Radio, Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga sits down with Leo DeVries from Science for the People to discuss all of this and more. Here they are now in conversation. Take a listen.
Hey, Leo. So thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Thank you, Gabby, for having me.
Just to get started, could you introduce yourself and Science for the People a little bit?
So my name is Leo DeVries, and I'm in an organization called Science for the People. We're a group of radical scientists working against war and exploitation and trying to organize in our workplaces for a more democratic future of science.
So you mentioned that part of what your org does is working against war and militarism. And last week, we had Canada and Prime Minister Mark Carney join onto the pledge to commit 5% of GDP to defense spending by 2035. And so I'm wondering, you know, what is you and your organization's reaction to that?
So, I mean, looking at this is going to create a lot of jobs in STEM. Right. So this involves us immediately. We see that scientists have a moral crisis when they're in university. People join the programs in science, in math, in computer science, because they might be very interested in the topic itself. They might be pursuing knowledge for its own sake. They have a passion for science in general. And people are also joining these programs because they want to get a job that helps people, and they want to build the infrastructure that we all need. And then they find that all the jobs are in militarism. They're in defense contracting. I have a math background. And so as someone with math background, you have like a few big money makers in the industry, right? You can go into big tech. You can go into espionage. CSIS is always recruiting math grads, as well as its sister agency, the Communications Security Establishment. You can go into insurance, and you can also go into finance. And all of these pose ethical issues. They're exploitative industries. You can make a lot of money, but I mean, these are all based on militarism, on exploitation, and they're on very inefficient ways of allocating resources, right? Like I can make a lot of money investing, but that's a lot of money that could be used towards infrastructure that people actually need. And people in engineering have it even worse because tons of jobs are for places like Lockheed Martin. And the jobs that don't involve defense contracting are actually pretty few and far between. So, I mean, this is going to create a lot of new opportunities for science grads, but none of us have any say in how science is actually used. And then we're told when we bring this up and we say we don't want to be doing work like this, we don't want to be designing weapons of war. That's just how it is. And you know what? You're being political. And science is not political. Engineering is not political. And I think the message of Science for the People is, no, science is political. Science is a tool of politics, and it can be used for war and militarism, but it can also be used to create a better world and more equitable world.
You know, this increased defense spending could create a lot of jobs, a lot of opportunities for workers in STEM, in the sciences, which, you know, when you first hear it, sounds like a really great thing. So how do you kind of, as an organization, approach that topic when you're hoping to challenge this militarism and this kind of push towards the military industrial complex and defense industry?
Well, we are an organization of scientific workers. So you might think, oh, well, this sounds right. Workers are winning by doing this. But in truth, workers are not winning. I mean, first of all, it is very anti-democratic. I mean, we don't get to decide what kind of scientific work that we do. All the money is in things like defense spending and espionage. Well, important research that's done in universities, scientists have to fight for scraps over it. I mean, NSERC gets a lot less money than the defense industry does. They have a lot less to play with. And so researchers who are doing vital work have to fight for scraps and not know if they'll have enough money to actually continue the research the next year. So this is definitely working against democratization in science. But also, I mean, we're a global organization of workers. We don't just stand with workers here. We stand with workers all over the world. You know, we're not just looking at Canadian workers having good benefits and good salaries. We're looking at, for example, workers in Palestine who have bombs being dropped on them right now. I mean, every university in Gaza is destroyed. Are we talking about those scientific workers? Are we talking about their conditions? They're living through something unimaginable right now, and it would be a dereliction of duty to not talk about them, to not consider them. So if we're considering a future for all scientists, democratization of science, we have to think globally. We're not just thinking about people in Canada.
I think this idea, too, of the democratization of science is really interesting. Can you tell me a bit more about what that would mean, what that would look like if science was democratic?
So, I mean, I think that scientists should have more freedom to choose the research that they do and know that they will be supported by funding agencies that give them grants. I mean, this culture of science is this kind of cutthroat. It's this culture of competition, of fighting over scraps, of applying for uncertain funding from NSERC. And if we had the funding that we needed, science could definitely be a lot more collaborative. I think that's the draw of science, is like working together to further knowledge for humanity. And instead, we are locked in competition and perverse incentives to kind of backstab each other. And, you know, even within that culture, people are very collaborative. I think people naturally want to work together. But I mean, first thing is getting all the money that we need. And also, I want to call out the institutions like universities that help their graduates find jobs. You know, they push things like defense contractors for engineering students. I have a friend who's in geology, and, you know, all the job postings everywhere are for mining companies or petroleum companies. I mean, these are highly exploitative industries that not only destroy the environment, but also are stealing indigenous land all over the world and creating, you know, they prop up corrupt governments and destroy the way of life of people in Africa and in the Philippines. There are other jobs in geology, and there's a lot that needs to be done, but you really have to dig to find it. There's also a lot of work that just isn't funded at all. Talking again about geology, there are hundreds of thousands of tons of arsenic piling up from mining in the Yukon and in other parts of northern Canada because of mining industry. You know, these mining companies go and dig up. They have no care for any kind of environmental considerations. They pollute creeks. They go into indigenous territory and ignore what the governing bodies actually have to say about what they're doing. They skirt regulation, and then they leave a huge pile of toxic waste to clean up. And there's no funding to do it, and nobody has figured out how. And people who are researching how to actually deal with this kind of toxic fallout, they have no resources. So what a democratization of science would look like is actually giving consideration to scientific work that actually needs to be done. No one wants these defense contractors to do what they are doing, but they get all the money from the government. They they're propped up by billionaires and wealthy corporations. That's not why I went into STEM. That's not why most people I know went into STEM. And I think that if we actually had a say in it, these defense contractors would shrivel up and disappear. I also want to talk about some examples of democracy in action that I've seen. There's two examples. So the first one I want to talk about is the Cuban Doctors Program. This is a spectacular example of foreign aid, something that I think as a much wealthier country that we should be doing. We should be looking to Cuba as an example. You know, this is not a rich country, but they have a surplus of doctors. They put all their resources into funding medical programs and recruiting high quality students from around the world for scholarships to study in Cuba. And then when they graduate, they are sent on missions to other countries. Any country that wants a Cuban doctor, they'll send as many as they can. And those doctors have only one goal, which is to do their best to heal as many people as possible, give the highest quality medical care possible. And, you know, they exceed their goals every single time. And Cuba doesn't ask a penny in return. They don't ask for anything. They just send their doctors, they do their job, and they, you know, and then the doctors leave. This is an example of what happens when a government actually prioritizes science for people, for global solidarity, rather than just pure profit. Cuba sends these doctors to other countries and they don't get any money in return. And I mean, that's the kind of work that people go into when they want to go into medicine, when they want to go into science. People in Canada, when they go into medicine, they'll encounter a system full of systemic discrimination against racial minorities and against people with disabilities. We're in an environment with increased privatization. There's not enough doctors here. People are leaving to go to the EU, where they have better conditions. And I think if the government was serious about solving these problems, it would model itself after Cuba and try to build up a surplus of doctors and offer, you know, this kind of compassionate diplomacy, not one of domination or like give and take, but one where you say, we have more than we need and we'll offer you something and we don't ask anything in return. And the second example I want to talk about with respect to democracy and science is a Palestinian birth worker. These are midwives. These are doctors. These are people who monitor birth from all the way from conception to the actual birth. And then the natal care after it's done. And, you know, they're working in conditions of siege. There are no resources coming in. So it's just based on improvisation. I mean, if you're a midwife, you have to work by lamplight in a tent while bombs are falling around you. There's no floor, there's no sanitary surfaces. And so Palestinian birth workers have innovated this whole system of doing birth work in these conditions, and they're successful. There's still people being born in Gaza even in these conditions. They're able to save mothers' lives when there are birth complications. I mean, these are scientific innovators, and they'll never be recognized by the Nobel Prize Committee or other prestigious scientific establishment, but they're scientific innovators, and I think that we have a lot to learn from them in terms of using science for democracy and for bringing power to the people. I mean, these people in Gaza are living through these unimaginable conditions, and through this kind of scientific work, they're able to demonstrate their resiliency and to survive these horrific conditions of genocide.
Yeah, those are two really interesting, I think, cases to look at. I want to ask also about the profit question, which always comes up. You were talking about mining companies, defense industries, things like that. What would you say to people, you know, who argue these industries are very profitable and they actually bring in a lot of revenue for Canada that could then be spent on our social programs and things like that?
They bring in a lot of revenue for sure. There's no question about that. But where does this revenue go? Does it actually go to people in this country. I mean, sometimes, but we're seeing that our social programs are actually drying up our Canadian healthcare, which is something that I think most people in Canada are proud of, is being increasingly privatized. People can't access basic services, and now people are actually turning to private healthcare. They are finding doctors that they have to pay because the public healthcare system has been gutted so much. So I say, like, if we're bringing in all these profits, where is it going? It's just piling up in rich people's bank accounts. It's being reinvested into more mining projects. So I do reject the idea that bringing in more money is necessarily better for all Canadians. But let's say it was. Let's say it was being reinvested. Let's say we were benefiting from it. I would say it's still immoral because, you know, every dollar that comes in from a mining company that's operating in northern Canada or in the Philippines or in the Congo, that's a dollar stolen from the indigenous people on the land. That's thousands of people who are being displaced for this mining operation. And that is ultimately destroying biosphere as well. You know, even if we're making a lot of money and funding our social services, what is it worth if in 25 years we are fighting water wars and our planet has heated up to such a degree that we can't reliably grow food anymore? There's no amount of money that can get you out of that situation unless you work democratically. I also want to bring up the idea that, you know, somehow these mining operations or these very profitable operations are good for scientists. Yes, they do create jobs, but I mean, they don't help out the scientific community in general. Grad students are still making pittance. They can't afford places to live on their own while they do important scientific work. So, I mean, the scientists who work for these companies certainly benefit these companies, but they don't produce valuable scientific knowledge in general. We don't need to know the geology of the Philippines in order to be able to dig it up. That's just not something that's valuable to humanity in general. It has so many adverse consequences. It costs so many lives. And in the end, all it does is bring in money for rich mining companies.
I mean, it's very clear to me that there is something tangible that Science for the People is fighting for, which is like the democratization of science. I'm curious, so how do you kind of go about, you know, organizing in these like scientific communities among students, among workers to start to push for this?
I think the first step to this is to have scientists. These are people working in professional environments, or their graduate students or their professors recognize that they are workers and that they have a common interest with other scientific workers. And once you have that, you can get people to realize that they have an interest in working together. And when you have people working together, you can change quite a lot. So we have a handbook called Organize the Lab, which gets into this. It starts out with speaking to the scientists as workers, and then how to get people in the same scientific workplace to work together. And our goal is to get scientists in different parts doing very different work to come together and recognize their common interests in democratizing science, in not just having defense contractors and mining companies control all this money, in having the government cut scientific funding year after year. I mean, we have the power to change that, but we have to do it all together as the scientific community working together. I mean, our next projects involve organizing at universities. I think we're going to try and build networks at Carleton University in Ottawa in the coming year. And then our other work focuses on writing our magazine, very high quality magazine. We get a new artist to do the cover of each edition, and it's just beautiful art. It's like painstakingly crafted. Each magazine has submissions from scientists around the world, and each one's about a different topic. So over the last year, we've had three. We've had one about genetics and gender. We've had one about indigenous knowledge called Ways of Knowing, about how indigenous practices contribute to science and what we can learn from that as scientists. And then the newest one is on Palestine and how Palestinians are using science as a tool of liberation while under siege and under bombs and under conditions of what Amnesty International has called apartheid and genocide.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Can you share the name of the magazine too, so our listeners can look into it?
The magazine is called Science for the People. You can order print copies from scienceforthepeople.org, or you can read all the articles for free online. But I encourage you to buy a print copy. These are beautiful editions. We get professional printers to do it on very, very high quality paper. And these are very well-written articles with beautiful art.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Leo, for joining us on Rabble Radio today. I learned a lot about the scientific community and the organizing that happens in there. So thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Gabby.
That was Leo DeVries in conversation with Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Leo. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's go to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with labor news. Union leaders and pro-Palestinian activists are calling for the reinstatement of a paramedic for the York region in Ontario, who was fired after making statements against Israel. Catherine Krasechek was fired as a paramedic by the York region last month after stating that Israel was committing acts of aggression against Iran and committing acts of genocide against the Palestinians living in Gaza. Krasechek is a member of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, Local 4900. CUPE Ontario says that her firing is a violation of her charter right to freedom of expression. In response to a question from Rabble, York Region claimed that Krasechek's statements had somehow violated the municipality's inclusion charter. CUPE Ontario President Fred Hahn condemned York Region's firing of Krasechek, saying, quote, "We argue that it's not only everyone's right, it is everyone's obligation to speak out against atrocities. Indeed, it is the only way that they can be stopped. We're shocked that the York Region would fire a paramedic for having empathy and solidarity for people who are suffering." End quote. Staying with labor news, a new short documentary film highlights the realities of incarcerated workers in Ontario and Canada more broadly. Titled Working for Freedom, the film chronicles those who engage in prison labor and the conditions under which they work. One inmate at the provincially run Ottawa Carleton Detention Center in Ontario received a bag of chips and a chocolate bar for 1 week of work. In the federal system, wages are capped at $6.90 an hour for a full day of labor. In the provincial system, incarcerated workers are often paid in canteen funds. Much of the labor done by prisoners is work that is required to keep the prison functioning, like cooking, cleaning, and maintenance. Jordan House, a labor professor at Brock University, says the film that prison labor is coercive and menial. However, prisoners do want to work. House noted that there has been organizing among prisoners to make their jobs safer and more dignified, but there are still many complaints about the lack of meaningful work. In Alberta provincial news, Prime Minister Mark Carney has set a date for August 18th for a by-election in the federal riding of Battle River Crowfoot. Conservative Damon Couric had won re-election in that riding in this year's federal election, but chose to step down to allow his party leader, Pierre Poilievre, to run for the seat. Poilievre had lost his former seat in the Ontario riding of Carleton in that same election to Liberal Bruce Vanjoy. Poilievre had represented the riding for more than 20 years. As a result of his defeat, Poilievre has not been present in the House of Commons since it returned this past spring, and former Conservative leader Andrew Scheer has been serving as interim leader of the opposition. One factor that led to Poilievre's loss in the federal election was the Longest Ballot Committee. The Longest Ballot Committee is an activist group dedicated to raising awareness of electoral reform. The Longest Ballot Committee put over 100 candidates on the ballot to run against Poilievre in his Carleton riding. Now, ahead of the by-election in Battle River Crowfoot, the longest ballot committee is seeking 200 people to run against Polyev. In environmental news, Rabble columnist Ole Henriksen is warning of governments pursuing greater levels of extraction of natural resources in response to uncertain economic times. Governments in BC, Ontario, and the Canadian federal government have all passed legislation aimed at fast-tracking economic development projects. Most of these pieces of legislation involve disregarding environmental regulations and consultations with Indigenous peoples. Not only do these pieces of legislation violate treaty rights of First Nations, but also threaten the environment. Many of these resource extraction projects would emit great amounts of greenhouse gases, worsening climate change. And finally, staying in environmental news, Dave Suzuki is calling for greater focus on so-called Scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions. In order to make fossil fuel projects seem environmentally friendly, companies and nations try to offset greenhouse gas emissions these projects produce. What often isn't accounted for are the greenhouse gas emissions created when fossil fuels are exported and burned by a third party. These are Scope 3 emissions. A recent ruling by the European Free Trade Association Court found that fossil fuel projects in the European Union must be evaluated for their total global impact, including Scope 3 emissions, before they are approved. Suzuki said that while this only applies to the European Union and countries like Norway and Iceland, right now it is an important step to further reducing greenhouse gas emissions and fighting climate change. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.